It's a pleasure to have Professor Tuft today with us. Professor Tuft doesn't need much introduction. As you all know, he was one of the recipients of the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1999 for his work on quantum electrodynamics. And he also done very important work in black holes and quantum gravity, as well as fundamental aspects of quantum mechanics. Today is going to tell us about quantum black holes without strings. So without any further ado, I'll let Professor Tuft take it away.
Okay, thank you very much for inviting me. And sorry for a few minutes delay, but we're all ready now here to start. Let me see if I can actually get the screen working. Oh, this is something new now. Ah, I have to do it this way. Okay, well, so what we want is a theory of quantum gravity and the black holes and everything. But I don't quite understand the way people are handling black holes using strings or ADS, CFT. I always find the results extremely unclear, and I would much more prefer to have a Hilbert space, a Schrodinger equation for black holes. And actually that is what I'm trying to get, a description of a black hole using a Schrodinger equation, and then use that using the following philosophy. I first have to explain my philosophy on the screen here. If you want to a theory that unifies all forces and includes the behavior of space and time, then of course it has to include both gravity and quantum mechanics. So the difficulty in today's theories is of course the inclusion of gravitational forces, as we all know. So what would be more natural than trying to look first at those situations where the gravitational field is as strong as it ever can get. And the field is as strong as it ever can get near the immediate vicinity of the horizon of a black hole. That's where the gravitational potential basically goes to one and even beyond. So that we have to have straightened out first before even trying to set up a complete theory for quantum gravity. So my first remark here is that black holes are much more important for quantum gravity than just a little issue that has to be discussed on the side. That's usually often the way people seem to be looking at black holes. That's not it. Black holes will be an essential element in any theory of quantum gravity. And so our first priority should be to get at least black holes straightened out, to make a theory that makes black holes to behave like any other form of matter. Then we'll be on our way for understanding the rest of the gravitational force and try to understand completely how to handle general coordinate transformations. And indeed, I think my talk will show that that is indeed more than necessary. If you don't understand black holes, you're missing out on some very important issues, whatever you try to do with gravity. So don't just approach gravity from the perturbative end, but also look at the fundamental non-perturbative things such as black holes. And then you'll start to understand more about the general theory. So as I hope you can still see my slides. Many researchers have heard about my approach towards the problem of quantizing black holes, but they get the impression that they're not taking it very seriously. And I think it is extremely serious. I think also what I'm doing is the most direct way to handle black holes. So it should be incorporated in any good approach for quantum gravity as such. So often people start with extreme black holes, black holes embedded in anti-de Sitter space or something like that. But no, I think the most urgent thing to do first is have the prototype of the black hole, the Schwarzschild metric, have it not in the extreme limit, but have it in a more general way. We can, of course, later add rotation and charges in black holes by going to Reisner-Nordström and Kerr-Newman. But yes, and secondly, I want this to be embedded in flat space, just because the most urgent thing to understand are the very small black holes, which for all practical purposes will be embedded in flat space time, not an anti-de Sitter. So that would not be the ideal way to handle black holes such a way. So this is why I put in my title, I'm not attaching strings to black holes and not putting them in funny spaces with strange boundary conditions. My priority is a black hole like Schwarzschild, just in flat space-time. And so this talk is an advertisement for the approach that I have. And I would love to get more interactions on this whole topic. And of course, critical remarks are always more than welcome. I think the issues some people have with firewalls are basically resolved the way I do it. And also issues of entanglement do not really arise in the way I look at black holes. Although at the very end, I have something important to say about entanglement, so it's not totally trivial. But at least what I'm striving at is a description of a Hilbert space, a Schrödinger equation, evolution law, and see how everything fits together for black holes. Then you can later ask about other circumstances, like, for instance, an evolving universe and so on. So what I will do is I'll start with something like the standard model, augmented with perturbative gravity only. Now, that part of the theory, I think we fairly well understand. Perturbative gravity is not renormalizable, but you have to realize that even if you are a few orders of magnitude away from the Planck scale, then renormalization is only a secondary feature of the theory. You have to add counterterms. Yes, eventually you'll need infinitely many counterterms. And no, we're not going to accept that. We want a better theory than that. But let's start somewhere. And very often in physics as well as in mathematics, if you got the full perturbation expansion of a certain theory, then sometimes you can figure out how the theory by itself works, how the equations hang together, and so on. So this is the general philosophy. And what my second problem is, when I see many approaches to black holes, is that people always consider the metric of a black hole shortly after it was formed out of a black hole, out of a collapse into a black hole. Well, the collapse only takes a few, let's call them picoseconds, a very, very short amount of time the collapse takes place. And then the black hole itself, at least in the classical theory, the general relativity theory, the black hole itself goes into almost stationary mode. It'll be stationary for thousands of years, and then eventually it'll do something, but only on a very long time scale. The stationary problem is a very important problem. And my philosophy always has been, let's try to understand that first. Let's not limit ourselves to a black hole just formed, because that is a situation which is very much time dependent. And so you'll have to solve completely the time dependent problem, which is much, much more complicated than a problem when a black hole is nearly stationary. If you look at a black hole emitting Hawking particles, it is almost stationary. And even if it captures light particles, it will only moderately react upon that. So the stationary black hole is a very essential thing to start with. So let's call the time scale for a black hole typically, well, I call it a nanosecond, but you can give it a name you like. It's just the time, this, which is a little bit longer than a Planck time, but the time it needs for black hole to form and to do something. That is the time which is longer than the Planck time by a factor, black hole mass divided by Planck mass. So the Planck mass is the short time scale. The black hole mass generates a slightly larger time scale. That time scale I want to look at. In that time scale, the black hole formed in just a few picoseconds or nanoseconds. And then if you look a year later, you'll find something that is very alarming. You find that those particles that you still wanted to include in your metric that formed the black hole a year ago have now been boosted, according to the local observer, boosted to an energy which went exponential in the black hole time, in the black hole time units. So that would be, you get momenta inside the black hole, which are the Lorentz transformation during 1 year over one nanosecond. So those energies are e to the power. I don't know how many zeros you have there, but this number is ridiculously big. And it doesn't make any sense to keep that contribution to the metric in your description of a black hole, because that will explode. That is not a station, a way to describe a stationary black hole. If you reach this kind of energies in a small thing as a black hole. So when you encounter numbers like this, you know that you are doing the wrong kind of physics. Of course, in a much later stage, you might want to make a theory as so accurate that even numbers, corrections of this sort will be important, but not now. We first want to get the big picture. And so it doesn't make sense to include matter which made the black hole if you want to describe later the stationary situation. You should ignore that in the past. That is very important. And now I hammer on this point several times in my talk to show that something drastic happens if you ignore these particles, which are carrying so much energy inside the black hole without you seeing it. Because when you look at the black hole, you don't see that there's this amount of energy in the black hole. That's ridiculous. Those numbers don't make any sense. And you don't notice anything of them. So something has to be done to make that disappear. And so what I will do now is I'll try to use the Hilbert space of a standard model system near the black hole horizon, but only use it in as far as the particles are not extremely energetic and everything is just in the vicinity of the domain of science where we still think the standard model with perturbative gravity makes some sense. When I talk about perturbative gravity, what it really means is that I do take into account gravitons, but it's in a perturbative manner. They are still a weak contribution to the theory and not yet not in a stage that they dominate everything else. They will eventually dominate everything else, but in another way, which I'll try to explain. So I'll start with this theory. And so in other words, I'm strongly motivated to first look at a stationary black hole. And this square here on its side is the Penrose diagram for a black hole as far as it's outside the horizon. What happens at the other side of the horizon, as yet we don't know, but I just want to formulate the problem that we encounter already at this stage. So here you see, these are the two horizons. This is the past event horizon. This is the future event horizon. There are particles moving into the black hole, which also always move into the black hole at this end. They cross the future event horizon to get into the black hole. If anything arrives out of the black hole, it always came out with the past event horizon. This, I thought, was logical and needs no further explanation, but I get nasty questions from people. They say, wait a minute, this violates causality. The ingoing particle goes in here, the outgoing particles come out here, but this is much earlier. So the outgoing particles always came out earlier than all the ingoing particles, because this past event horizon is in the past of the future event horizon. So how can that be then that in such a black hole, the outgoing particles might actually depend on what you send in? Eventually, this is what you want. You want a Hilbert space of black hole that tells you how the black hole reacts on particles going in. So those particles going in must have some effect on the particles going out. But here that seems to be impossible because the particles going in are going in much, much later than the particles coming out. But that is only optics. You have to look a little bit more carefully. And so are we violating causality? And I claim, no, we are not violating causality if we take the following idea into account, that the local observer here, when this observer close to the intersection point of future and past event horizon, when that observer makes a Lorentz boost, then that is a time boost for the distant observer. So always remember, a distant observer, when he spends a short amount of time, the local observer makes a Lorentz boost. So when I take the ingoing particles, but I Lorentz boost them to the past event horizon, that is just a small amount of time for the distant observer. Whereas if the distant observer sees particles out, but waits a few more seconds for those particles to arrive at him, he'll see the particles coming out here. So now the magic is not that the late particles, the outgoing particles are coming out before the ingoing particles, but they meet each other at this point. So all you have to do is try to understand the physics of this meeting point between out particles and in particles, which may be a domain of the black hole diagram, black hole space time, which is very close to the Planck scale, in a Planck length or less away from the intersection point of the two horizons. To expect that something happens here is not crazy. And my suggestion is that you have to understand what standard physics tells you about this intersection point. And standard physics doesn't answer everything, so there are still miracles about what happens here, but it answers some things. And the question you can ask is, how does the gravitational force affect of the ingoing particle affect the outgoing particle? So they meet each other at this point. Where they meet, they may interact. Ordinary standard model interactions won't do very much. They'll give a small correction to these particles being not exactly free particles, but very briefly seeing each other here. But if they come in at different points on the horizon, then that the standard model forces are very weak. But there's one force which is not weak at all, and that is gravity. The reason is very simple. The gravitational force gives this particle, or not the gravitational force, just the metric here, makes this particle, as time goes on, squeezes onto the past event horizon, and it's multiplying its momentum by a factor every picosecond onwards. So very soon, this becomes a strong source of gravity. It becomes a gravitational source so strong that you can no longer ignore that. And many people just ignore it. They think they're ingoing particles or outgoing particles. They cross each other. And what happens at this point, you don't care, because either the outgoing particles are virtual or ingoing particles are virtual, so you don't see anything happening. That's not true. You won't understand ingoing particles. You won't understand the outgoing particles. Both set up a Hilbert space. You want eventually a scattering matrix, an evolution operator, that tells you how the Hilbert matrix, Hilbert space of the future particles depends on the Hilbert space of the past particles. So they're not all virtual at all. They are really particles which meet at this point. We have to understand what happens at this point. And that is where I now say, I'm now concentrating this point. This pink region here is a region where you expect quote unquote new physics. It doesn't have to be completely new. I think that today's understanding of gravity and standard model forces already tells us a lot about what happens here, because we can still wait until they're not yet a Planck's length away from the origin, but maybe 10 Planck lengths, then ordinary physics should tell us what happens. So let's compute what we know about it. It's not completely new physics. So what does low energy physics actually reveal about what happens at that point? This I've given this talk already several times, so this might not be a completely new. What we have is the so-called Shapiro time delay. If you have a very heavy particle going to the left, this is this red arrow here, and you have a spectator particle going to the right, the green arrow, then if this particle is boosted to enormous velocities, enormous momenta, I should say, then it gets a gravitational field that you cannot ignore. That gravitational field will be a sonic boom. And the not a sonic boom, but a gravitational boom. And that gravitational boom will drag this green particle along for a distance delta u. And you can calculate delta u, and that is just standard physics. No secret, no mystery at all, just standard physics of general relativity. You just take a stationary particle, boost it to very large velocities, and you can calculate that shift. And that shift is given by this expression here. I won't tell you how it's derived. It's fairly straightforward. And everything in this formula is quite normal. That the delta u is a light cone coordinate in the ingoing direction, u minus. Delta u minus is proportional to p mu, p minus, the momentum of this particle in the same minus direction. And if after a Lorentz transformation, u minus will increase, p minus will increase, they go the same way. So this expression is the only Lorentz invariant expression that does it. So yes, u minus is proportional to p minus, also proportional to Newton's constant. And also this logarithm is not very surprising, because this sonic wave, this particle, this gravitational wave the particle carries along, is really in a two-dimensional transverse space. So this is a solution of a two-dimensional Laplace equation. Of course, it's a logarithm. What else could it be? The most difficult part of this expression is the factor minus 4 that you have to calculate. And okay, that has been calculated correctly to be minus 4. This is in flat space. So now you can do the same thing in this in the vicinity of a black hole. The minus 4 gets a little bit more complicated inside a black hole, but that's just a detail. We see the same thing happening with a particle crossing the horizon. Here, the red particle, the same red particle I was looking at just before, is now entering a black hole. And we wait a little bit for its momentum to increase. It's being attracted by the black hole continuously. Every picosecond, the momentum of this particle gets multiplied by a factor. So it very quickly joins the past event horizon, and its source becomes so big that it drags the outgoing particles along. Now, the outgoing particle here is dragged inwards, and all these colored particles are spectator particles. The blue particle is the easiest one, is dragged inwards and goes out a little bit later than otherwise you would have expected if this red particle didn't go in. But there's also this green particle, and there's this pink particle. Now, you see the pink particle comes from the forbidden region 3. This blue particle comes from forbidden region 4. Any particle from region 4 is being dragged this way. Now, my claim is that the green particle will be dragged this way. It will be dragged by the same amount. This dragging effect is basically distance independent in this whole picture. We're all very close to the horizon here, and this is just a constant. So this amount of drag also occurs here, but the green particle can't come out anymore. It, in fact, undergoes a very strange phenomenon. It is dragged along from region 1 to region 2 in the black hole. So it's dragged this way, and my claim is now it will come out like that. The pink particle comes from here, is also dragged in the same direction, and comes out like that. Now, I imagine if you have ever looked at this before, you might have an objection. You might say, wait a minute, you did it wrong. Because here you see that the blue particle is forming a little delay and takes this particular shape. Its stretcher takes this shape. You see that the pink particle here, the stretcher takes the opposite shape. It seems to be dragged inwards rather than outwards. Whereas here it goes inwards. This is dragged outwards. Isn't that wrong? My answer is, yes, I would have thought so, that this was wrong. And originally, I didn't do it this way. I thought the red particle would also go with a shift in the other direction. But no, if on this past horizon, there's a Cauchy surface of outgoing particles all swimming on this black horizon here, the past horizon, then all the ingoing particle does is drag them all along the same direction. If you say all particles are dragged in the same direction by the new force, then if these particles form the Cauchy data of is Hilbert space, then the whole set of Cauchy data is just dragged along in the same direction. And I don't want any information to get lost here. So I don't want this green particle to get lost, the field to fall between the crevices of the theory. No, the green particle is also shifted and it comes back out in this direction. So this green particle came in this way, but decided to go away from not to argue, to leave the system in region 1, but leave the system in region 2. So this is demanded by unitarity. It seems to be contradicted by applying local physics here, but it's a little bit more subtle than local physics. In fact, the ingoing momentum here tells you what happens if you add this red particle. Here, what happens seems to be telling what happens if you remove the red particle. So removing the red particle gives this shift. This is a removal because this thing is dragged outward from the horizon, whereas this thing is dragged inward. If you want to drag something out of the horizon, you have to remove this incoming momentum. So positive momentum here instantaneously must shift into negative momentum here. And then all these particles sitting on this Cauchy surface will continue sitting on the Cauchy surface, but the information will be preserved while the whole lot is being dragged in the same direction. This is a very subtle, very important component of my argument. And I can imagine that you won't accept it completely just by me saying so. So you just have to ask me to allow me to continue. And later you'll see how this whole picture is going to make sense. So I'm talking about Cauchy surfaces. Of course, you have to do that. These particles are lying on a Cauchy surface. But because I see the Cauchy surface that it will be tempted to be dragged along across the horizon, I'll need a Cauchy surface that goes from infinity to here all the way to minus infinity in the other region. So whether I like it or not, I'll have to include region 2 of the eternal black hole to be part of the picture. If I don't, then the information will get lost at this point by the Shapiro effect. Now the Shapiro effects will say, no, it's not lost, it's just being removed to the other domain. What you also see is I put here the diagram of the eternal black hole. I ignore the ingoing matter. That is because ingoing matter would be much, much too singular. It wouldn't leave region four like this. It would completely destroy the picture by a factor 10 to the power a billion times a billion. So those are the ridiculous numbers that you don't want in any theory. So those are the only possibility to describe the stationary black hole is by using Penrose's diagram without matter. So indeed, what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at the theory where the only particles I'm going to look at are so light that you can ignore the gravitational fields, except when they are causing a Shapiro delay here. If they are moving the Gaussian surface around, then I can totally ignore that. But all other gravitational effects are small and are to be ignored. So this is a very important ingredient. Here you see the Gaussian surface at a different stage. So the Gaussian surface is now this red line. As time goes on for the observer here, time goes from below to up for this observer in region one. In region two, time goes downwards. Again, I've seen people in string theory who do it wrong, who could say the Gaussian surface will go like this. But if you say that, then the Gaussian surface will very quickly be killed by the singularity, and that's the end of it. You can't describe the particles of region three because nobody can see those particles. The particles that can be seen by the outside observer are also region one and region two. And now you see that indeed the time evolution will keep the particles always in region one and region two. The ordinary Lorentz transformation will see how these particles will evolve far away from the horizon. The Shapiro shifts will tell you something non-trivial about the center of this diagram that has to be sorted out. So this is now, the rest of my theory is going to describe how that really happens. So Seska and Maldacena, for instance, they had the Gaussian surfaces not go like this way, but to join this point from that point by having the whole thing going up. They wanted time in this diagram to go in the same direction as that diagram. It unfortunately that can't be. If you do that, then after a few picoseconds, you're being killed by the singularity and the whole picture stops. So that is not the way to describe a stationary black hole. Now, we were forced to include region two in our picture. Now that seems to be a disaster. That seems to be completely wrong again. I suddenly made my universe twice as large as it was before. I'm basically describing two black holes, one region one and a region two. And people like Hawking and others and Seska and Maldacena and other people say, now there are two black holes, not one. And somehow they are connected by this Penrose diagram. And they thought that this has something to do with entanglement of two particles. I think it has absolutely, this has nothing to do with entanglement. Entanglement will come in my theory, but in a very different way. These particles, in fact, cannot possibly describe two black holes. And that is because there's a direct interaction at this intersection point. The Shapiro shift causes those two regions, region one and region two, to talk to one another. And if they talk to each other, it means that they can send information from one to the other. In fact, you should be able to send information from one side of the black hole, from one the region of the black hole to the other region of the black hole. That would be forbidden even if they were entangled. You're not allowed to use entangled particles to send information. As you know, Eisen, Rose, Podolsky, they could never send information from one photon to the other photon. All they could do is have these photons entangled. So there's something else that you have to do. You have to try to divide space-time by a factor two. So we have to find a symmetry group of the form Z2 and say, now I'm going to say that symmetry divides space-time by two. It's like having a gauge field Z of the form Z2 somehow and divide the number of points by factor two. What will this Z2 group be? And my claim is now the following, that Z2 describes antipodal identification. If you try to go from region one to region two, you will not emerge out of a different black hole, you will still be in the same black hole, but seen from the other side. And I'll try to motivate why I think that that's the only possible answer. So we have the so-called antipodal identification. It turns out to be a boundary condition on the horizon. This circle here, seen from the side, looks like an ellipse. This circle is actually a three-dimensional, a S2 sphere, it's the horizon of the black hole. But at this horizon now there's a boundary condition saying that this region of space-time is connected to this region, but it's not connected like the way you usually draw. But if you try to approach the horizon, you hop over to the other side and you get out of the same black hole from the other side. This sounds very strange, and I didn't believe it myself when I first had the idea that something like this has to happen. But let me explain to you why this seems to be true anyway. And that is that we are searching for a group Z2 that keeps this, the metric intact. So it should be an isometry of the metric. Now, since the black hole itself hasn't got so many isometries, but it does have O3 as an isometry, not only SO3, but also O3. So you can make a rotation of the black hole in any way you like. So the first idea was take an element of O3 and take one element of that and call that Z2. And this element A must have the property that A square equals one. Why? Well, I can go to from region one to region two, but I can also go the other way. But then I should get back to where I came from in the start. So A squared must be an entity. That means all eigenvalues of the A, which is an element of O3, are either plus one or minus one, because the square must be one. Suppose there was a positive eigenvalue, then that would have an eigenvector. You can easily write down the eigenvector for if O3 has a positive eigenvalue. You can find this eigenvector. It's just a vector in three space. And that would be a point that would be mapped into itself by the Z2 mapping. But when Z2 maps a point on itself, you'll get a cusp singularity at that point. That would invoke singularities in general relativity. We like to avoid that. So I like to avoid all eigenvalues plus one because they generate singularities. That means all eigenvalues have to be minus one, or A is just the element minus one, which is an element of O3, of course, not of SO3, but O3. Actually, not only the space coordinates are flipped over, also time is flipped over. I already showed you actually that time goes backwards in the other region. So I also have to change the sign of time. So I have actually a four matrix with four eigenvalues minus one. And this is now the isometry that links one side of the black hole to the other side of the black hole. This does not give any singularity. And the reason is that it's happening on the horizon. And the horizon is the point where you get the smallest possible sphere in the black hole, which maps things onto itself. And that sphere doesn't shrink to zero. So on that sphere, you just have to go from one point to the antipode at the other side, but that's always a finite distance away. So you don't get any cusp singularity at all if you use this matrix. It is the only matrix that avoids cusp singularities. And this matrix says that at the horizon, you have to identify antipodal points. The horizon is not an S2 sphere, it is a projective S2 sphere. And all the rest of space-time doesn't change. So, but now I've divided all points in the universe again by factor two. So that now this is the Penrose diagram, the eternal Penrose diagram is still now a valid one-to-one mapping of outside space-time to the entire space-time that you have in a black hole, but it's one-to-one. The original eternal black hole Penrose diagram had a one-to-two mapping. You can't have that in quantum mechanics. If you want to set up a Hilbert space of all states, you should never have a one-to-two mapping. You must have a one-to-one mapping. Then you have a group mapping where every element or every particle is mapped into a particle sitting somewhere in the other coordinate frame, but it's only in one spot, not in two spots. Of course, when you do quantum mechanics, you have to do that because you have to avoid overcounting. You have to avoid quantum copies and so on. So only by ensuring that you've divided out Z2, you get a problem that now the standard model in that original square which I drew, that standard model will now allow me to build up a Hilbert space for the black hole itself. So this is the remark, this is the essential starting point. Now, I mentioned here some time sign switch problems. That's the problem of the momentum going to minus momentum if you get through the horizon. That again has to do with this minus one in the time direction. So in the time direction, energy goes to minus energy, and momentum goes to minus momentum. So what you see here is that opening up for a black hole, when a black hole gets formed, and it lives for a while, and then it decays again and makes Hawking radiation, that whole process can be regarded as an instanton in four space. The instanton is a hole which I dig out of four space, and I say this cross here is identified, that cross. All the antipodes in four space are identified in this thing. This empty region in here is not ordinary empty space-time, it is nothing. It's not even space-time. It's just my space-time is the blue region, and I have to connect antipodal points, which causes the space-time to be curved, but that is what a black hole is. So the black hole in its entire history is like a gigantic instanton. And you can start with very small instantons at the Planck size, you can think of such instantons, but now you see the entire black hole is an instanton as well. This thing, this empty thing I call a vacuole, which is even empty, it's not in space-time in there. I have some collaborators in Utrecht, these three postdocs, and they worked on this topic for a while, and they've been working also on trying to find if there's really a solution of the field equations. Now, ordinary gravity equations don't like this configuration, but they tried to have a Young-Mills field in there, and they nearly got there, but just not quite, but they found something that looks like an instanton of this kind, and want to know, of course, what this instanton does to the rest of physics. Imagine this instanton to be like the BPST instanton in gauge theories, and the important effect they have is well known. So maybe instantons of this kind will sooner or later be found in quantum gravity. And the smallest one are then virtual black holes, which are formed and decayed immediately at a very short amount of time. So the smallest black holes are just instantons. And for a stationary black hole, at first sight, it seems that very strange that also time has been reflected. But of course, you have to remember that at the central point of the Penrose diagram, time, as seen by the outside observer, stands still. So yes, time gets reflected if you go across from here to here. Now let's go back to this Shapiro effect in the gravitational shift, because that's now going to be the central part of the theory. And I had this equation. You have a very similar equation on the black hole horizon when a particle moves into the horizon and it sees other particles getting out. The other particles are getting out, but they are being held back by a Shapiro shift. It's like a time shift. And the equation is now this, just like the equation I had before, except for the one here. The one comes from the curvature of the horizon. And delta omega is the dimensionless Laplace operator in the angular direction. So in case of the eigenvalues, eigenstates L and M, this is L times L plus 1, this delta omega. And this is just the equation for the Green's function that describes how the Shapiro effect happens on the central point of the horizon. And so what we now find is that if you send in a particle with momentum P minus into the black hole, then I can take all particles that I send into the black holes and add them all together. The effect is additive. So in spite of the fact that we're talking about a very nonlinear theory, general relativity, this effect of general relativity is linear. So it's easy to calculate. And it just happens to be linear, that the Shapiro shift is a linear function of the ingoing momentum. And that's given by this equation below. So because it's linear, you can do a lot of physics and mathematics very easily. So that's what we are going to do. We take many particles and then say this is a distribution. And now the shift caused by all these particles together is a distribution multiplied by this Green's function. Now here I have the equation again, and I'm going to replace it by this equation. Now you might say, wait a minute, these equations, aren't they identical? Yes, nearly. But if you look carefully, you can see the difference between these two equations. Here I talk about the delta P, saying if I make a little change in the ingoing momenta, I get a change in the position of the outgoing particles. But my next remark is, why talk about change? Maybe the position of the outgoing particles themselves is caused by the momentum of all particles that ever went into the black hole. So I leave out the delta. So the momentum of the incoming particles, they determine the position of the outgoing particles. That actually changes very little, because I still have to say where the origin of this u space is. So by choosing the origin, you can always go from this equation to that equation saying, no, I'm just getting an absolute equation. This here, this green equation here, looks like the beginning of building up a scattering matrix, a matrix that relates in particles to out particles. Now, this u min is just a shift caused by p. So I call this a footprint. So the in particle going in momentum p has its footprint, leaves its footprint in the particles going out. My claim is now this is much more than a footprint. The outgoing particles are the footprint. So they look like a footprint the way I calculated them, but they also describe particles. And in fact, by quantum mechanics, I can relate p to u. The momentum and position are related by quantum relations. So that's why I can say, okay, I can turn this around. I can take the Fourier transform of p and the Fourier transform of u, and then again, I get the same equation, but now upside down. Now it's not the past event horizon where I'm looking, it's a future event horizon where I'm looking. If I replace p by u, I get actually the same equations with one subtle minus sign in them, because doing the Fourier transform twice gives you a minus sign. Well, those things you have to take into account. This also will remove the firewalls, and I'll say more about that later, that originally an incoming particle was hanging onto the horizon stronger and stronger and stronger. But after a while, it causes so much gravitational havoc that it generates what we call a firewall. By now replacing that particle by its footprint, you say now it's not an incoming particle anymore. It's an outgoing particle, just with this relation. And going out, it just leaves the black hole. That's not a footprint, that's just a particle. So, and there's not a firewall either. So by identifying this u by the outgoing particles, I basically removed the effect of the incoming particles, and I also removed the firewall. In fact, I've also removed the problems with the firewall, I claim. So now comes the next step. I'll go through this quickly. I have given this talk before, and this is going to be a little bit technical. You don't have to memorize all this. My slides are available. You can ask them at the secretariat. But you can write this relation between in and outgoing states in terms of the spherical harmonics. I introduce the L and the M. So L and M, so I expand the distribution of the incoming particles and distribution of outgoing particles in spherical harmonics YLM. Why do I do that? Well, in terms of the spherical harmonics, this Green's function is just diagonal. It's just a function of L and M. In fact, it's L square plus L. That's the L square plus L is a Laplacian in the angular direction. The plus one, which I had before, is now added here. So you get L square plus L plus one. And the Green's function is just in the space of the spherical harmonics. It's just 1 over L square plus L plus 1, multiplied by Newton's constant and 8 pi. And this is a diagonal equation. I can also now insert quantum mechanics. Because every incoming particle has a momentum, it also has a position. And momentum and position are related by Heisenberg's equations, actually, that the commutator between the u and the p is just identity. If it is the identity for the particles, it's also an identity in the spherical waves. That's an elementary calculation. You discover that the L and the L prime don't talk to each other. Only the L's and the L prime only talk to themselves. So the commutator is only non-vanishing for every spherical wave separately. But different spherical waves, different spherical harmonics, do not talk to each other. This means that our problem is going to be a one-dimensional quantum problem. Just one operator ULM and one operator PLM related by this simple relation, saying that one of these operators is just a Fourier transform of the other, like it always was in quantum mechanics, and that is it. This puts me in a position to set up a quantum mechanical Hilbert space and a quantum mechanical evolution operator. So it is so simple and straightforward that now it's easy to get that evolution operator. And but there are certain amount of gymnastics which I still have to do. It's all straightforward, but if you see it for the first time, it might dazzle a little bit. But the thing is that for the local observer, these operators U and P depend exponentially on time. I said that the distant time boost is locally a Lorentz boost. And Lorentz boosts multiply the minus components and divide the plus components by effect e to the power plus or minus tau. Tau is a time parameter for the external observer. So these are exponential things, and they are here being Fourier transformed. I want to go from exponential things to linear things. And that is relatively easy. I just say that the U and the P, both the U and the P, are the exponent of some other operators. They are called rho in and rho out. Rho in is a coordinate of an ingoing particle. Rho out is the coordinate of the outgoing particle, or it is the momentum of the ingoing particle. It's the same thing. But since I exponentiated U and P, I can't immediately affect the sign, because you know the sign of the exponent is always positive. Whereas both these operators went through both regions 1 and 2, and region 1 is minus the region 2 coordinate. So I have to keep the sign in spite of the fact that I exponentiated things. So I put a sign in front. Sigma in is a sign. You get which just be plus or minus. Sigma out is a sign, it's plus or minus. So now I don't have just the operators rho in and rho out, I also have a sine function. But that's just a plus and a minus, and that's all. That doesn't make things too difficult. I can still do ordinary quantum mechanics, but now I have this exact quantum number, plus or minus, in my equations. And I want to plug all this into the commutators here, and I want to understand now what the operators do. How are the in and out things related? So now, if you exponentiate, you see that the rows are just linear in tau, and rho in and rho out are just linear in time. So rho in just increases indefinitely as time goes on, and rho out goes in the other direction as time goes on. But when the particle is far enough from the black hole, it's no longer exponential, because now it's the linear time parameter that you see. So then you see particles just move out as a constantly increasing function of time, and the ingoing particles came in with a constantly decreasing function of time until they came very close to the horizon, where time started to become an exponential. So you had these equations. So all this is very straightforward. It just needs a little exercise. The nice thing about this picture is that if you look at the time dependence, you find that all the equations are obviously invariant for time. I looked at the stationary black holes. These equations are invariant on the time. It's non-trivial, because these U's and P's are exponential in time. But you know about a Fourier transform, if X is multiplied by a constant, then P is divided by that constant. And that's exactly what's happening here. So actually, I have my equations which invariant become independent of time. So what I can do is I can send in a energy eigenstate of the particles as seen by the outside observer. So the outside observer puts a particle in a wave that's just a constant wave, with a constant frequency as a function of energy. So it goes like e to the i kappa times tau plus or minus rho. Tau is time, rho is this rho parameter. And kappa is now the energy as seen by the distant observer. So distant observer puts the states, ingoing states like this. Now I make this funny Fourier transform and ask, what does this do to the outgoing particle? It gives you a couple of equations which are very easy to solve. You can give it to an undergraduate student and he'll solve the equations for you, because it's very straightforward. But you have to put exponentials in exponentials. This is the Fourier transform, relinking P and X. But now I want to exponentiate P and exponentiate X. So I get an exponential in an exponential. Okay, if you find that difficult, it's not very difficult. You can solve this. You can say, wait a minute, this gives you a new kind of Fourier kernel, but the Fourier kernel is a bit more complicated because it acts on the exponential functions rho x and rho p instead of the p and x themselves. So you get a little bit more complicated expressions with a Fourier kernel that now behaves exponentially as a function of this kernel. So instead of e to the I p x, I get e to the I times e to the I rho, and so on. So the Fourier kernel is going to be a function that looks like this. At one side, it just is very soft, because I'm at the soft end where just this function becomes a very small exponential. But at the other side, this function becomes a positive exponential. And at the other side, the function becomes oscillating very, very wildly. As soon as you introduce a minor cutoff in this Fourier transformation here, you get that this oscillation will stop somewhere. You can also say that although this is a function with an infinite support, you can say that very soon, this exponential has dropped to a very low value. You can ignore what happens behind it. This oscillation goes so fast, you can ignore that too. So for all practical purposes, this is an integration kernel with almost compact support. And this is the way we look at it. We'll integrate this thing with this constant wave that the outside observer says we evolved with convoluted with this wave. And then you get some integral to do. And the integral is just, I get that psi out is a function psi sigma in acting on this wave. And the psi in is a function of psi out. And I have to write them as I am splitting out the energy dependence here. Sorry, I was forgetting what this equation is going to say. This just tells me I'm going to go into energy eigenmodes, and here also an energy eigenmodes. And then I get a closed equation. And lo and behold, I can do all the integrals, and out you get a bunch of gamma functions. The gamma functions come out because they result from this from an integral. Let me see where. Oh, yeah, the integral is this integral. This is the integral over a variable y raised to the power 1/2 minus. Yeah, 1/2 comes from normalization, and it's an I kappa, and so on. So this leads to an ordinary gamma integral that you all learn at undergraduate math classes, that this is the gamma function. And it's a gamma function for a complex entry, so you get exponentials with an I in here. The 1/2 generates a factor e to the minus pi over 2 kappa times sigma. Anyway, if we go back to this expression I had here before, this is what the S matrix is coming out from. I have outgoing wave functions and I have ingoing wave functions, and they are related by a 2x2 matrix. That is just the signs which I was talking about. And this gamma function is just this integral that I worked out here. And if you look carefully, you see that the off-diagonal components tend to be bigger than the on-diagonal components by a factor e to the power pi kappa. And that is because a particle with large momentum tends to be dragged inwards into the diagram, not outwards. So because of that, the contribution that links the region 1 to region 2 is larger than when you go back from the same region. And this is a closed expression for the black hole scattering matrix. It tells you how incoming matter is being transformed into outgoing matter. So these are the equations I already said. So what do these equations describe? I realize I went a little bit fast in this talk, so you didn't follow the details, nor did you have to. You can just take your own time to read about it. I have my papers written down, and then you can go through all the details. I just want to say what the physics is behind all this. I use partial waves. That is tricky because the particle itself is not in a partial wave. These partial waves are not wave functions. They are actually operators. They are momentum operators or position operators, average position operators and average momentum or sum of momentum operators, which means that I'm not describing every single particle. So although I had a beautiful S matrix, it doesn't contain as much information as I wanted. It also tells you what the average particles does when you all add them all together and what the average particles do when they come out in either the average position or average momentum in partial waves. And that's not quite the same thing as these particles. Also, partial waves are waves, so they have plus and minus sign contributions. The minus signs are referring to region 1, region 2, and the plus signs region to region 1. So that you have to take into account. But all that is basically straightforward. It's just mathematics. And so a particle has its position theta and phi fixed, basically. And you can make them in wave functions. That's not exactly the LM wave functions I'm talking about, because these are operators, not wave functions. The nice thing about the equation is that all the LM operators decouple from one another so that you get these beautiful closed expressions. So now we can follow everything in detail. Everything is linear, so we can solve the equations in detail. And now, I can now ask, what about these regions 1 and region 2? Well, since the shift from the in region two is the opposite of the shift in region one. And remember, I had the minus sign if you went from region one to region two. That means that only the odd values of L are allowed. I can only look at ways where L is odd. Whereas L is even is a situation which still has a factor two because there's the two regions are being described, both by even L values. By taking half of all L values, I divided all space-time points by factor two. But since for the odd L, as I get both regions one and two, I can multiply by two. But altogether, of course, I have exactly the same number of space-time points as I always had when we're looking at all space-time. So the outside space-time just has the right number of states. But there's this funny thing about the L and M antipolar works. Now, the very important question that many people ask correctly is how could this antipolar identification, which I'm talking about, how could it come about? What happened when the black hole collapsed? Did suddenly points were identified, not only that, but the time was turned upside down? How did that come about? That's a very important question, and I don't have the complete answer to that. But I can always say this, that the thing I've been able to describe very precisely is a thing which has a time-like killing vector. So that's only black holes which make very small changes, not large changes. Now you can bring about a large change by having many small changes in succession. The black hole mass is not constant. And that is because as soon as a particle leaves the scenery very far away, then it drags along that amount of mass. And what's left behind has a slightly smaller mass or energy, or just the other way around, depending on if you have ingoing particles, they add to the mass of the black hole. The outgoing particles remove mass. So mass just conserved, or energy is really, I should talk about, is conserved. So I can have a time-dependent black hole as long as the time dependence is slow. To have a fast time dependence is very difficult. In principle, you can imagine how also fast time dependence should be taken into account, but then you have to take into account this vast amount of matter which made the black hole in the beginning and which leaves the black hole the moment that it explodes completely in the final Hawking explosion of final black hole. All these things happen when the black hole is very small. When the horizon opens up, it's still the Planck size or smaller. So, and that's the very moment that you have to impose the new boundary conditions. But exactly how this boundary condition comes about has everything to do with this transformation I made, where I say to the particles that I replace the footprints by the particles themselves. That was a big manipulation, which in fact caused the boundary condition at the black hole horizons to be changed into another boundary condition. My time is running short. I still have several of those remarks to be talked about. So when I the estimates I talk about turns ingoing particles into outgoing particles, it means that the ingoing particles are about to make a firewall of ingoing particles. But by replacing my outgoing particles don't cause a firewall at all, not at the past event horizon, at the future event horizon, they effectively remove the firewall. But that means that I only have to look at particles with low energies. If I do this sufficiently smart, I only get low energy particles, never high energy particles, so never give a particle even a chance to make a firewall. I remove the ingoing particle, replacing it by the outgoing one by just saying that that's the footprint that you have to look at and not the original particle. So replacing the particle by the footprint of the outgoing particle, that basically removes the firewall that the ingoing particle was about to make. But that goes at a price. If you remove the firewall, it means that if you go through the horizon, you'll actually go through a different firewall. You originally thought you were going through a firewall, but now you're not going through a firewall. You're just going to some other space. That's a totally different space. Now, that is the antipode of the same black hole that you enter into. Now you have the eternal black hole. You have these two regions. So region two is now the other side of the black hole. So what happened when you remove the firewall, when you replace the footprint by a particle, is that you readjusted the way the horizons are connected inside a black hole, but in such a way that you never need to talk about regions 3 and region 4 of the diagram. So you never need to worry where the information disappeared. This is the ideal solution of the information paradox. There is no loss of information anywhere. Information in region 1 goes to region 2. Doing this, I no longer needed these high energy particles, but I had to modify the boundary conditions at the horizons. Since this involves either the very, very distant past or the very, very distant future, but not the present, I'm not making any change in the description of the present of the black hole, only a description of the very far past and very far future. And the philosophy there is that if you study a hydrogen atom right now, you're not asking to modify the hydrogen atom because of the way it was formed during the Big Bang or sometime in the distant past of that hydrogen atom. No, I'm looking at the hydrogen atom now. I don't need to know what it did during the Big Bang. I just want to know its wave functions only through a few picoseconds. One can compute very, very well how the hydrogen atom behaves because it can take it temporarily in a time-independent state, energy eigen state. And that's all you really want to know about the hydrogen atom. Same thing for black hole. I just want to have a small stretches of time where I can compute exactly what happens. If you want to glue two short stretches of time together to get bigger stretches of time, you have to take into account some particles might have escaped during that moment, or some particles might have entered the scenery during that moment. You have to take them into account, but don't worry about them making a firewall, because now you can replace two energetic ingoing particles by my far away outgoing particles and so on. So if the momentum of the ingoing particle becomes large, it's the position of the outgoing particle becoming large, but that just means the outgoing particle leaves the black hole. And that is again completely irregular, can be described by ordinary physics. So you see, by applying ordinary physics, you recover a lot of interesting information about the black hole behavior. Only if you would not be doing that, if I would not identify the antipodes, then I would have the problem of getting impenetrable firewalls, which would invalidate most of the theory. I have some remarks here. I think I might want to cancel this because I just want to recuperate that the early ingoing particles have exponentially enhanced momenta, but their position operators are quite small. As soon as we find their position to be too small, their momentum to be too big, I replace them by their footprints. And those footprints are then good descriptions of outgoing particles, again, using low energy physics only. So doing that, I get a very consistent picture, a prescription how to work with black holes. It is the only prescription that works. I'm not saying I really derived everything. I've said that this is the only way I can handle black holes such that they work and I give a valid and useful evolution operator. And then you can say, okay, that's a necessary property. Now let's see what it has to say about ordinary standard model. So this way I've justified what I'm doing seems to be correct, but now to make it completely correct, you still have to do lots of work. You have to understand how this gravitational instanton actually works. It is the quantum fluctuations, exactly how do you understand that in terms of what really happened in the black hole. And all that still requires lots of analysis. But the important remark is that if I do it my way, then I see that the black hole estimated is completely unitary. It works. There are still many problems. There is, for instance, a problem at very high angular momentum. I can count states, but I get an infinite number of states belonging to the very high angular momentum, very high values of L and M. Now, at high L and M, there's no Hawking radiation. All Hawking particles only have low values of L and M. So that if you make some approximation which is not quite right for very large L and M, don't worry, those particles will not really enter into the picture. So if you say that, then you find a finite number of states, because at every given L and M, the number of states is indeed finite. That I can compute. You can compute from this direction, the argument directly, how many states there are at a given L and M, and that's just a finite number. But at large values of L, they all keep coming. And at some point, you have to cut the whole line off. Exactly how to do that, I don't know. So so the very heavy particles are then replaced by, as I said, I repeated several times now. This is again a repetition of what I said before. I wanted to say something else. There is something more. And that something more has to do with the inversion of time. If you connect two regions of space-time, but you turn time around, then you also turn the Hamiltonian around. And there's a problem there. And that's the last thing I want to say now. This is sort of being the last page. The Hamiltonian also goes to minus the Hamiltonian. So bam, here comes Ed Witten saying, now you did it wrong. There is no minus Hamiltonian. And you have to replace I by minus I somewhere. How do you do that when you connect two regions of space-time? It's wrong. No, but you have to say that Hamiltonian is not the ordinary Hamiltonian, not just minus Hamiltonian, it's E max minus Hamiltonian, the maximum amount of energy. So suppose there's not only a vacuum state, which is the lowest energy state, there's also an anti-vacuum state, which is the highest energy state. And the vacuum is connected smoothly to the anti-vacuum at the other side. And then you can see that now both regions have a positive Hamiltonian, but the energy has to be the maximum energy if you go at the other side. You can complain. You can say, wait a minute, if there's so much energy at the horizon, why don't I see the gravitational effect? Well, that was exactly the firewall that we removed. So so you can say that at the horizon, yes, there are lots of particles there. And yes, you'll see that there are some particles there. They actually cause the Hawking particles to come out. So the Hawking particles really come from the super vacuum, from the anti-vacuum, to dissipate into our world and escape. And those are actually the Hawking particles. So you can relate that to the fact that there's Hawking radiation. In theory of deterministic quantum mechanics, but that's another talk in quantum mechanics, the anti-vacuum and the vacuum are very important notions. And they actually can be mapped onto each other mathematically, as you might have expected, because it's just replacing I by minus I, but in physics and in mathematics, replacing I and minus I should not be any problem. So yes, you can do that. Mathematically, if you ignore the gravitational force, because gravity acts on Hamiltonian, you can't have an infinite amount of energy, then the whole thing gets haywire. That's again the same problem of that firewall, which I removed. But now you see how things are going to hang together. At the horizon, the equilibrium state must be halfway. So at the horizon itself, the vacuum goes into anti-vacuum. So you're halfway, so you have lots of particles there, and those are the Hawking particles. The reason why I'm holding on to this picture is that this gives me the unitary evolution law, and it gives me a black hole that's very neatly behaved. Some people say that a black hole is chaotic, and when they say chaotic, it says they really mean don't ask any further questions because I don't know them. Well, this black hole is in a sense chaotic, but as chaotic as a hydrogen atom. You could say the hydrogen atom is chaotic if its eigenvalues do not relate by rational numbers, it would be chaotic. But in fact, the hydrogen atom is quite clean in practice. The black hole in practice is exactly as clean as a hydrogen atom. And I think I should stop here. I have still many questions to ask, but you might want to ask questions as well. These are people I collaborated with, some postdocs at our institute, and a graduate student who is still at our institute. The all three graduated at our institute. And these are some undergraduate people who also did some useful calculations here. I should really stop, and I hope there's still time for questions, even though I went beyond my time.
Right, so let's thank Professor Tooft for the talk. And we still have a few minutes for questions. So
I do have a few questions. Hello?
Yes.
Yeah. So I have several questions. One question is about this antipodal map. As you may know, you know that as at for the S matrix at infinity, you can write, you can show that the S matrix satisfies Ward identity that comes from the soft theorem, the collinear singularities, and then but these Ward identities are due to a symmetry which is, you know, some kind of generalized BMS symmetry on sky plus and sky minus. But in fact, you need an antipodal identification of sky plus and sky minus to make that thing really work. So the natural question is whether this antipodal identification that defines the S matrix in the usual manner is related to yours.
I don't know the exact answer to this question. This is one of my undergrad students who went into those papers, and he claimed that yes, he found all sorts of relations between what is considered the antipodal identification of people encountering in the BMS group and what I've been doing here. He sees all sorts of relations, but it's a bit difficult. I must say I don't quite understand what kind of symmetries they talk about, but in a way, there's some kind of transformation you can perform on the horizon that it could be the translation that linearizes gravity. So just saying that you can make this light cone transformation on the horizon.
Mm-hmm. But he's making that connection, if it's the same, maybe would support you.
I don't think it's exactly the same, but I think these notions, the observations they make, they must be connected
must be connected. A related question about this map, maybe it's something you said very fast at the end. Are you going to implement this map unitarily or anti-unitarily?
That's a good question. I don't know really what you mean by anti-unitary, but there's indeed the danger of I going to minus I.
Yes, yes.
So, yes, I should have said, I mentioned, I think on the slides, I had the words PCT, saying that you have parity because you went to from O3 to minus, to the minus element of O3. You have time invariance as well. So easily it's a four matrix with four minuses.
Yeah.
So, and then I said, well, since you have P and C, P and T, you must have C as well, because nature is not invariant on the PT alone. Mm-hmm. Nature is only invariant on the PCT. Yeah. So you must have the particles going to antiparticles in a sense. But of course, if you replace creation by annihilation and vice versa, of course, that already replaces particles by antiparticles. So it's quite natural that you have a transition of describing particles to describing antiparticles.
Which is anti-unitary then, which is like time reversal.
Yes.
Okay, yeah, next. Maybe it's a technical question, you went fast. I kind of understand, you know, why the, what you call the Shapiro effect, which maybe I would call the memory effect. It's kind of the same thing that, you know, of one energy displacing the other one, create an S matrix. It seems to me that's all you, I mean, I'm missing maybe some technical detail. I understand why that would create an S matrix, but I don't see how the Z2 identification plays with that. Or am I wrong that the Shapiro effect is not enough to, anyway?
No, this was derived before we realized that there should be an antipolar identification. This just says that there are particles in region one which cause a shift. The ingoing particles cause a shift in the outgoing particles, no matter how you, whether you identify these two regions or not. But then we realize this is not an ordinary S matrix. This describes two universes. So something is wrong with this picture. Mm-hmm. Then we realize we have to get a factor two out somewhere. And the only factor two that doesn't violate basic notions of physics, like we don't want any cusp singularity in space-time, forces me that there's only one natural answer, which is obviously right, which is the antipolar matrix, the minus one everywhere. Then you don't get any singularity. And so where's my, oh yes, this. So now you make this transformation, you get through here, but instead of continuing this arrow here, you hop from this point to the opposite point, and then you come back in the metric in this direction. So you really removed half of space-time, this half of this diabolo diagram.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
we have more questions.
Yes, I would like to ask a question. This is a bifurcate horizon. This is a Killing horizon. So at the fixed point, you do the mapping in such a way that it is not the conifold or orbifold, what in string models is called orbifold. As I would like to say, it's a very nice result. I'm very, very happy about it. My question is to your, I don't know how many years ago, but you had some picture about the behavior of standard model on the event horizon, about the kind of transmutation of, may I call it transmutation of spin, lowering by one?
That is long ago. I had some pictures of that sort. I was trying to put the standard model back in, and this was among the questions which I only flashed by at the end. But one of the questions is that I haven't yet done the standard model. This only thing I've done is I've looked at the momentum and the positions of the integral particles, and that is it. In fact, that you can compare that with what people do in string theory. This point here at the center is actually a two-dimensional space, because it's the S2 horizon, which sits in Euclidean space. It's an S2 in Euclidean space. But that S2 has many similarities with the string world sheet. And indeed, you can consider the ingoing particles and outgoing particles as being vertex insertions in the string world sheet. It goes the same way. But those vertex insertions in string theory then generate other fields. So now you can make vector fields and other objects go in and out. And you see string theory did succeed in translating that in terms of vector fields and even spin fermion fields, besides scalar fields. I haven't gotten that far yet in this theory. I believe that there should be a very similar kind of algebra here at this central point that treats it as if it were a string world sheet. The danger is that the string world sheet is Minkowskian and not Euclidean. So it has a minus sign in the time direction, whereas this sheet does not have a minus sign in the time direction. And actually, this is a string theory with an imaginary string constant, if that means anything. Well, for all the string theories, that would be very strange. But in this different setting, it's mathematically very similar to string theory, but physically very different because of the factor I in the string action. This has an action just like string theory, but without the I, where string theory would have an I, or where this theory has an I. There's a factor I difference between this theory and string theory. An I, which translates eventually as is the string action being I times what it used to be.
The
reason why I say that is that this string theories managed to get standard model-like particles getting in and out of the string world sheet. I haven't gotten that far.
But they got it too much. They got too much. All infinite number of states.
Yeah, well,
higher spins are inconsistent.
It would be great if one could set up Kac-Moody algebras and such on this string, on this horizon instead of the string world sheet. So do the same gymnastics as the string theory people made. It looks like this should be possible, but I don't really see how. And the Kac-Moody algebra was coming about by subjecting strings to Lorentz transformations. This is not Lorentz invariant because the black hole itself is sitting somewhere. So I have to reconsider how to arrive at this Kac-Moody algebras in the first place. So
the way I see it, you discovered the identification is because it actually shows that there is no way you can have a static picture, meaning instantaneous time picture when you have a rotation group, SO3. Basically, a sphere is acted on by SL2C, which is basically Lorentz group.
Yes.
And this is, of course, a conformal group of in two dimensions. So you can embed the mapping you have as an element of SL2C or GL2C.
That is true. Our former graduates also did things like this. They look at the conformal part of the theory at this point here, and basically, well, yeah, you could say that you really have the Lorentz transformations, not the conformal transformations, but to some extent you can try to keep the conformal part of this interaction here.
Yeah, the old picture before maybe early 70s for the black hole was what the Russians called Chernaya Turma, which is a basically frozen star, a dead star. But then, of course, people discovered, of course, this diagram that it is actually dynamic, time dependent, and so on. So, of course, the transformations you have, they actually give representation to the view that black hole is always dynamical. You have to look at the bigger group, local group than SO3. The SO3 appears when you are instantaneous at a particular time. And the mapping you discovered there is, of course, an element of the extended group. Actually, it's the Lorentz group.
Yes. So the Lorentz group is central here. But you can also say general relativity is because of theory with a much, much larger invariant groups. It's actually totally invariant on all coordinate reparametrizations, local. So it is a complicated gauge theory rather than just a global group that we should be looking at.
I have a remark.
On our end, yes.
I have a remark on what you call Shapiro. It is Shapiro, of course, and Mr. Friedel, of course, is mixing up the so-called memory effects and something else. Shapiro effect is something anybody who does science and pretends to do generativity or gravitation should understand, that Shapiro basically told people when they sent the probes in the 60s to Venus, they can actually look at the time delay. Okay?
Yes, yes.
This is the fourth test of generativity. It's generativity 101.
Mm. Well, this is a straightforward calculation, and it was reminded me. Well, of course, I was thinking of Shapiro as being related to experiments or observations on satellites, which go behind the sun, and you find that their signals are slightly delayed when the signals come very close. Yeah,
it's a radar ranging experiment from early 60s when U.S. sent vehicles passing by Venus.
Yes.
Yeah. So this was, of course, I don't remember this because I was a child, but I am told by the older colleagues who were involved in actually designing these vehicles in JPL in Pasadena, where I spent some time.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's move on to next question. Let's try to maybe keep it short because we're eating our half now. Let's see, there is a hand raised.
So I made my slides available to the secretariat if you want to read them in your own time. I mean, now you have heard me talk about it, and I always lose a little bit of time in the end. So you can just read them in your own time, whatever you are interested in. And I'm quite happy with any remarks that you can make.
Gerardo's final statement I would like to make is that this is all beautiful and very, very remarkably beautiful and elegant.
Thank you.
So is there any other question, quick one, or?
Yes, can I just ask a question? Go ahead. You were describing the Shapiro time delay in terms of basically single particle or single particle modes. Have you or anyone else looked at this as, you know, modes of a quantum field theory and what quantum state that corresponds to that you're describing with this antipodal identification? As you know, there's a long literature on various field theories and curved space and black hole backgrounds. And I'm just wondering how this description connects to that and what the stress tensor of such a state would be.
We certainly looked at that. I did it myself, but also the collaborators I mentioned, they asked questions like that all the time. So how does it go if you if you go to, if you add scalar fields, for instance, or if you add other particles.
Right.
I asked the question, what happens if you add electromagnetism? Because electromagnetism is, in this theory, electromagnetism also gives a sonic boom, but that's just Cherenkov radiation. And actually, in that respect, electromagnetism acts a little bit like a fifth dimension. So the mathematics of the electric fields of a particle, of charged particles, is just as if we are doing things in five dimensions, and the fifth dimension is just electromagnetism. And you can say, okay, this is a shift. In gravity, this would be a shift. In electromagnetism, this would be a gauge transformation. So a particle sees empty space-time here, empty space-time there, flat space-time, no photons, no fields, but just the field of a particle is being gauge shifted when a charged particle comes along. And then the whole story goes the same way, except there's no effect it has linking region one and region two. So electromagnetism doesn't do that. But so the gravitational force is a dominant force here. But electromagnetism does something interesting, and it tells you that the ingoing charges are related to the position of the wave function in gauge space for the outgoing particles. And so the relation between charge and a gauge is similar to the relation between momentum and position in the case of gravity. That's how far I got. And then you can ask about non-abelian things, you can ask about magnetic monopoles, and you get some qualitative answers there. Quantitatively, it gets difficult. For instance, the magnetic monopoles are quantized, and that quantization rule between electric and magnetic charges is nonlinear, it's quadratic. It's E times G is quantized. So in the case of electromagnetism, there already this situation becomes more complicated.
But that should be a
beginning of setting up this whole picture with standard model particles in it.
But even if you take a simple scalar field and just do your transformation here, is there yet no answer as to what state that corresponds to?
Or? Not a completely satisfactory answer. So the problem is, again, the information. We want the information to be preserved. Now, you see that here I have an effect that the momentum of the incoming particle and all information of the momentum of the incoming particle is being transferred to the information concerning the positions of the outgoing particles. So that is a one-to-one relationship, and you can relate that by quantum mechanical commutator relations and the fact that momentum is a Fourier transform of position. But we don't have that for other properties, certainly not for global charges. So you can't introduce isospin because there's no field coupled to it. So information about isospin just disappears like that. But you can say, okay, the standard model doesn't really contain such conserved charges, but it does contain three generations. How do I know which generation I'm in? And how does that information get back out? So we're not out of the woods there. It's still very, very, very mysterious. But that's the same kind of mystery that string theory people are just coping with today, that you don't really understand how string theory generates the right kind of standard model. I'm suspecting it for time being we'll have the same difficulty here to find exactly how the standard model fits in the whole picture with its always its curious characteristics of three generations, gauge fields, fermionic fields, fermionic representations, all that. How all that fits in is a difficult question.
Yes, of course, those are more complicated questions. I was just trying to ask, even for the very simplest case of a scalar, which is not necessarily.
Of course. So you start indeed, as you say, you can start with scalar fields.
Right.
But then I said, well, but the information that they carry seems to go away. And these discussions, you know, the postdocs I'm working with and the graduate students, they all come out with ideas, but they haven't yet the experience. And so,
okay.
So they thought that the scalar field, you could do something similar like this, but it's not that easy at all. So to make it all work, I think you have to make, okay, my philosophy is always make your steps as small as possible. You're quite right in saying that scalar fields are easier than vector fields or electromagnetism or spinners. Yes, but but maybe you have to make simplifications in a different way. And I thought regarding electromagnetism as just a fifth dimension is nearly as simple as this. So let's start there. But even that brings you into difficulties.
Okay, thank you for now.
All right, I think it's time to wrap it up. Okay. So thank you again, Professor Tuft, for a very nice talk. And for the questions, I'm sure that Professor Tuft is happy to receive emails or...
Yes.
Yeah.
So thank you. I'm delighted if someone wants to send questions by email or some discussion topic. I'm always happy to discuss things. Thank you.